Hi, and welcome to the Magazine Rack on Chris. I'm Tricia Beattie. Today I'll be reading articles from various issues of the Christian Science Monitor. In the limited time we have, I'll read from their section called One Week, which is a series of brief articles and commentary on the top stories of the past few days. Recorded on June 5th, 2024. Science and Nature. Are 200 million pastoral herders a climate threat? By Michael Beninov, contributor. In early 2020, just before the world locked down, I was in Ethiopia as a journalist, documenting the challenges faced by a tribe of nomadic pastoralists that has made its home in the Danakil Desert for over 1,000 years. About 1.5 million Afar tribespeople migrate across an area larger than Ireland, and often called the hottest and driest place on earth, with their camels, cattle, sheep, and goats to find grass. I found some of the threats to their way of life to be region-specific, such as conflict with a neighboring tribe, and locust plagues that decimated their scant rangelands. But some of their other even more intractable problems are shared by the estimated 200 million pastoralists around the world. The persistent drought, rising temperatures, and unpredictable weather patterns that scientists say are the hallmarks of climate change. Life used to be good here. There was once so much grass, and it grew so high that hyenas could hide in it, remembers Doja Moore, an Afar man in his 50s who didn't know his exact age. Now there is no rain, so there are no grasses. We can't keep cows anymore, and most people have very few animals at all. So what do we eat? Today, their way of life is under threat, not only from changing conditions on the ground. Pastoralist communities are also coming under pressure as a contributor to the global climate crisis. A December 2023 report by the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, for example, seeks to provide a comprehensive assessment of greenhouse gas, GHG, emissions from livestock agri-food systems. Some researchers say the report suggests that pastoralism is part of the emissions problem. That may sound improbable. Like other pastoralist communities, all of which are experiencing impacts of climate change firsthand, the Afar rely little on fossil fuels. They eschew consumer culture, partly due to poverty, partly because everything they own, including their huts, must be portable. But when researchers calculate the amount of greenhouse gases generated by a livestock system, most compare the amount of methane and carbon dioxide that's emitted to the amount of protein that's produced. By that measure, animals raised by traditional pastoralists are less efficient than those raised with newer, more intensive methods, the report says. This is partly because indigenous breeds of livestock, adapted to harsh environments, are less productive than breeds raised on farms. And a diet of wild grasses causes livestock to create more methane than if they eat formulated feeds. The FAO report stops short of condemning pastoralism outright. It notes that pastoralist emissions make up only a fraction of the world's total methane output. And it recognizes that moving away from traditional grazing may be unfeasible for the world's poorest countries due to nutritional challenges and financial constraints. But the report's recommendations point away from pastoralism. Is that pragmatism? Or a flawed narrative, like others that have pushed indigenous and pastoralist peoples off their lands? Climate policy experts widely agree that major changes are needed in agriculture, and notably in the raising of livestock, to help tame the rise of heat-trapping gases in Earth's atmosphere. If policymakers believe traditional herds stand in the way of hitting methane targets, pastoralists may be pressured to stop herding. Age-old cultures could disappear, along with food systems that make resourceful use of marginal lands where crops won't grow. Already, for example, a 2021 policy brief by The Lancet has recommended that India, home to some 13 million to 20 million pastoralists, needs to move away from the traditional animal husbandry practices in order to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Some scientists, however, say there's no environmental reason to turn away from pastoralism. The data behind the FAO report, and others like it, answers the wrong question, says ecologist Pablo Manzano, a fellow and rangeland expert at Spain's Basque Center for Climate Change. Researchers should focus on how methane levels produced by pastoralist communities compare with the emissions that would be produced by the same ecosystems if herds were absent, Dr. Manzano says. Many of those emissions are going to happen, whether or not livestock is there, he says. Should pastoralist herds be removed from their landscapes? The void that they leave would likely be filled by other herbivores, he argues, which would produce similar amounts of methane. And responsible grazing keeps grasslands healthy, increasing biodiversity, and providing a natural carbon sink, while reducing risk of wildfires, Dr. Manzano says. In an email response, FAO says it focuses on estimating methane emissions from all livestock systems, including pastoral systems. That approach leaves out the additional factors raised by Dr. Manzano. Questions regarding pastoralism are just one piece of the larger puzzle about how human land use and food production should evolve to address climate change. But to those who live in pastoralist societies, the implications are particularly large. Pastoralism is basically a fossil fuel-free, totally solar-powered production system that does not require feed inputs, fertilizers, or pesticides, says Ilse Kurla Rolofsson, a veterinarian who has lived closely with the Raika tribe in Rajasthan, India, since 1990, and who is a co-founder of the League for Pastoral Peoples. But it is under pressure worldwide and has in many places already become extinct. And a Far woman in Ethiopia once told me something that echoed the sentiments of many of the pastoralists I've met over the years. Our life depends on animals. It's all we know, said Hasina Wegris Al-Muhammad, who had just walked for 10 days across the desert with her cattle and donkeys in search of pasture. Despite the hardships of her nomadic life, she expressed no interest in trading it for a settled one. I never dream of moving to town, she said. The Home Forum. How a notary task sparked an unlikely friendship. I used to avoid running into Anne at Lane Towers. Now I long for our heartfelt chats. Are you a notary? Anne asked me as I walked off the fluorescent lit elevator and into the dimness of our apartment floor. She was hovering at the elevator bank, her gaunt frame hunched over her walker. Her blue eyes shone from her taut face, all encircled by a bird's nest of frizzy gray hair. Yes, I told her, not stopping to chit-chat. After an exhausting day at work, I just wanted to take off the pumps that were pinching my toes, change into sweatpants, and eat my leftover dinner in front of mindless TV. I did not want to notarize documents, something I did almost daily as a legal services attorney. Good, she said, likely sensing I was too tired to engage more. I will need you at some point. I had moved into Lane Towers a few weeks before and had already been accosted by Anne multiple times. She used our floor as her physical therapy room, slowly pushing her shiny red four-wheeled walker up and down the hallway in the evenings, after her home health aide left. Hanging from the front of her walker was a small stuffed chicken, yellow with an orange beak that curved into a smile. Anne was like that chicken, tiny and bird-thin. She always wore a soft wool sweater, even in the height of summer. If she ran into one of our neighbors, she would drop into the walker's black leather seat, settling in for a talk. The old-timers on the floor were happy to engage. The newer residents, less so. About a week after the notary conversation, my apartment intercom buzzed. It was 2 p.m. on a Sunday, and I was having a relaxing afternoon to myself. Hello? I hesitantly said as I pressed the intercom button. It was the door attendant. Anne doesn't have your phone number, he told me. So she asked me to buzz you. If you are free, she wants you to go into her apartment to notarize some documents. I let go of the intercom button, sighed heavily, and rolled my eyes. Might as well get this over with. I grabbed my keys and notary stamp and headed to apartment 10A. I rang the bell. Anne's face lit up as she invited me in. The large living room was awash in sunlight, with clear views of the Tudor-style mansions in Forest Hills Gardens, a neighborhood in Queens. It was April, but Anne had the heat pumping. I need someone to notarize these papers, Anne told me, as she guided me to the blonde wood dining room table with four matching spindleback chairs. On the table was a plate of bakery cookies, a French press full of coffee, and two empty mugs waiting to be filled. I need to see the photo ID, I told Anne, annoyed that she expected me to stay for coffee. Anne bobbed her head up and down. Of course, she said, seeming to enjoy the officialness of the task. Give me a second to find it. I took a seat at the table as Anne went into her bedroom to search for ID. I looked at the papers on the table. Half of it was in German, but the other half was an English translation. Life certificate, it said at the top. Anne made her way back to the living room, now opening the drawers of the console table. I know I have ID somewhere, she said. Anne, what are these papers for? I asked softly. To prove I am alive. I have to sign them every year to receive money from Austria, since they killed my uncle during the Holocaust, Anne casually said, not looking up from her search. I grew up in Vienna. My eyes became wide as I did the math. She must have been a young teenager when the Nazis came. Here we go, Anne triumphantly announced. She made her way carefully back to the dining room table, smiling as she handed me a driver's license. It was from the early 1990s, and while it had her name on it, the photo was of a woman with a full round face, fewer wrinkles, and smooth dark hair, perfectly coiffed. Her smile was barely noticeable, and the start of a paisley silk blouse with a matching bow tied loosely below the neck peeked from the bottom of the photo. After examining the driver's license, I paused. What was I supposed to do with a 20-year-old ID that looks nothing like the person? Notary law requires officials to verify the identity of the person with some form of government ID, preferably one that has not expired. But as I sat there, glancing from the stranger in the picture to smiling, eager old Anne before me, I wondered about the pain and misery this woman must have endured. Anne, please sign here, I said, pointing to the line for her signature. I then took my notary stamp and aggressively pressed it on the document. Coffee? Anne asked after we finished our official business. Yes, please, I readily responded. That Sunday would become the first of many weekend chats, and through the years, I would come to learn Anne's story. How she escaped Vienna on a Kinder transport. How, when she arrived in New York, she worked for the U.S. Army, censoring letters from German prisoners of war. And how one day her beloved Uncle Julius's letters from Dachau ceased. After raising a family, she earned her Bachelor of Arts degree in 1971 and went on to start a successful business career. It was from Anne that I learned what resilience really means and how fortunate I was to be born in a time of relative peace. In 2017, Anne passed away. I had moved a few months before. But whenever I go back to visit friends who still live on the 10th floor, I always turn to look at the door to 10A and, for a moment, long for my Sunday chats with Anne. Elizabeth M. Lynch. Arts and Culture. Welcome to retirement. So, are you ready to catch your first killer? By Ira Porter, staff writer. Ever since Miss Marple picked up her knitting needles, sleuths of a certain age have been genteelly wrangling killers while being ignored by the young folks. But the Thursday Murder Club has helped launch a trend of golden age detectives not seen since Jessica Fletcher last parked her bike in Cabot Cove, Maine. While catching killers rather than putting together jigsaw puzzles has become the hot new hobby for fictional retirees, these books are also showing people in their 70s and 80s as vibrant, brave, and clever. The Thursday Murder Club series by Richard Osman, about a quartet of septuagenarian sleuths, has sold more than 10 million copies worldwide. Oscar winners Helen Mirren and Ben Kingsley and former James Bond Pierce Brosnan have all signed into the Cooper's Chase Retirement Village to star in the movie version. While some authors play with ageism tropes to deadly effect, see Deanna Rayburn's Killers of a Certain Age. No, really, you should read it. Others like Mr. Osman take on diagnoses like Alzheimer's while writing fully realized characters who maintain their agency and humanity. Or think of Walter Mosley's masterful telling of a cantankerous 91-year-old diagnosed with dementia in The Last Days of Ptolemy Gray. With the help of an experimental drug, Ptolemy lives his last days with the vigor of a younger man and a memory to match, which helps him piece together his nephew's murder. Sometimes writers paint heroes grappling with mental health diagnoses, like the aforementioned memory loss, or with physical limitations. And they also amplify traits like experience, intelligence, and mental resolve, the flip side to physical decline. This offers readers new ways to view aging, experts say. These are the conversations about the incredible heterogeneity of old age, says Aaron Lamb, associate professor of bioethics at the Case Western Reserve University School of Medicine. She studies and teaches about aging. Dr. Lamb says that what is important to understand is that while many people choose to ignore older people and lean into stereotypes that portray them as invisible, that isn't true of older people's reality. We grow more and more diverse as we grow older because of our life experiences. And so all of these stories that begin to get to the complexity or begin to ask new questions, at least we're treating older people like they are people, Dr. Lamb says. In 2019, the British media forum Grandsnet did a survey of ageism in fiction of more than 1,000 women over 40 years old. More than half said they felt older women in fiction had cliched roles, and almost half of them said there weren't enough books about middle-aged or older women. These same women reported that they felt insulted by tropes of older female characters being baffled by technology. Especially since some 75% of those surveyed used technology to purchase the books they read. They wanted to see older women working, being more active, and going places that they would like to travel. A majority of those surveyed read for enjoyment. When feminist writer Betty Friedan wrote The Fountain of Age in 1993, she did a survey of images of older people that she did and didn't see in magazines. The images she saw were invariably of age, and older people themselves, as a problem. Ms. Friedan wrote, "On the one hand, despite continued reports of advances in our life expectancy, there was a curious absence, in effect a blackout, of images of people over 65, especially older women, doing or even selling anything at all in the mass media. On the other hand, there was an increasing obsession with the problem of age and how to avoid it personally, through diet, exercise, chemical formulas, plastic surgery, moisturizing creams, psychological defenses, and outright denial, as early and as long as possible." In Robert Thorogood's The Marlowe Murder Club series, he turns the trope of people feebly wasting away in nursing homes on its head with a witty protagonist, Judith Potts. Judith is a 78-year-old crossword puzzle specialist who occasionally skinny dips in the Thames. Her neighbor is murdered, and she uses her unrelenting curiosity to find his killer. She recruits a vicar's wife and a dog walker as part of her team. The novel, which inspired a TV series coming to PBS's Masterpiece, was followed by Death Comes to Marlowe and The Queen of Poisons. Mr. Thorogood, interviewed via a video call from his home in Marlowe, England, says that the next book will be out in early 2025. We have lots of men who solve murder mystery crimes. It would be exciting for me to have a woman lead up a murder mystery, Mr. Thorogood says of his initial thoughts during the creative process. He envisioned something in the realm of Miss Marple. His inspiration for Judith and her gang of crime solvers? His grandma, Betty, and his great aunts, all of whom lived colorful lives. Although one aunt, Jess, wouldn't let him put vegetables of the same color next to each other on his dinner plate. They were these amazing, really inspirational, bright women, he says. They were cleverer than their husbands. But the husbands had status and went off and had jobs and they wore suits, Mr. Thorogood continues. His answer was an older, independently wealthy, single sleuth who would outsmart the men and had no interest in ever getting married. He took that to his publisher, and Marlowe Murders was born. The process was the complete opposite for Ms. Rayborn. Her Killers of a Certain Age transports readers to foreign countries with four 60-year-old retired assassins, whose former employer is trying to kill them. While they don't have the physical strength of their youth, they have experience, wisdom, and a lifetime of spycraft to fall back on. The whole thing started with my publisher, Ms. Rayborn says in a phone interview. From high up in the company, the question was asked, why don't they lean into older women doing cool things? They were sitting around having a chat and they said, okay, who could we get to write a book like that? And everybody at the table said my name at the same time, she laughs. Ms. Rayborn, author of the Veronica Speedwell Mysteries, agreed to write the novel on two conditions. The women needed to be assassins, and the book needed to be set in contemporary times, as opposed to a period piece. Ms. Rayborn credits publishers being hungry for more books like hers, to a cultural shift brought on by everyday older people who have forced society to alter its view of them. I think that we're pushing the needle because of that, Ms. Rayborn says. People take better care of themselves, which has created a new picture about older people. And that more vigorous portrait has been amplified by the media, she says. Now we're saying, let's not just show somebody being healthy and vibrant and active in their 60s, 70s, and 80s and beyond. Let's show a broader picture of that, Ms. Rayborn says. Numbers in the news. 96.3 billion. Gallons of stormwater captured in Los Angeles County since October 2023. Enough water to support 2.4 million people for a year. The region has turned to water reclamation to tackle the opposing challenges of droughts and intensifying storms. 177 million. More older adults, at least, who could be regularly exposed to extreme heat by 2050, compared with today. The effects may be fiercest in Africa and Asia, where populations are booming and climate adaptability is low. 168. Run-ins between orcas and boats, on average, near Spain, Portugal, and Morocco each year since 2020. Reports Grupo de Trabajo Orca Atlantica. Scientists still don't fully understand the orca's motivations. 2,500. Coffee shops, approximately, in Kyiv, Ukraine. That number grew even after the Russian invasion in 2022, says research group Pro Consulting. Before the war, Ukraine was one of Europe's fastest-growing coffee hubs. 200,000. Bicycle trips undertaken in Chicago every day, the Chicago Department of Transportation and data company Replica found. A huge increase from 2019. Cross-town trips, for example, have increased 180%. 11,229. Babies named Mateo born in the United States last year. The name earned a spot on the Social Security Administration's annual top 10 list for the first time ever. By Jasper Davidoff, staff writer. That's it for this installment of the Magazine Rack. I've been reading from various issues of the Christian Science Monitor. I'm Tricia Beattie. So long for now.